Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Welcome to a special edition of Real Science Friday. All this week, we've interviewed Dr. Walt Brown on creation, evolution, and the global flood. And now today, I would like to take your calls, comments, so we could talk through the issue. Our phone number here is 1-800-836-9278. That's 1-800-8-ENYART. 1-800-836-9278. We've been offering all this week an autographed copy of Walt Brown's fabulous book, In the Beginning. We have about another 10 copies or so. Now, order this while supplies last. Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning. You could order it online at kgov.com. Click on the store or by calling us at the same number to call into the show right now, 1-800-836-9278. Let's go for our first question. To Thornton, Colorado. Jonathan, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
Hi, Bob. I was just wondering, since Dr. Walt Brown was on the show this week, in Genesis 1:7, when it says, God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so.
Okay.
What do you think that means? Does that pertain to the canopy theory?
Ooh, what a great question.
Can I just hang up and then just listen to your answer on the air?
Sure thing. Jonathan, thank you for that question.
All right. You're welcome. Thank you, Bob.
Okay. Wow. It's a good question because Christians debate, creationists wonder, is the firmament, is it the atmosphere? Is it outer space? Is it the crust of the earth? And the canopy theory is that the firmament was the sky. Henry Morris made this very popular with his book, The Genesis Flood, that above the sky was water vapor, and during the flood, that's the rain that came down. The canopy theory has been losing support among creationists in the last 10 years or so, for good reasons, as far as it seems that it wouldn't work. But also, when you look at what Genesis 1 says plainly, it talks about the firmament 9 times in one chapter. The first 4 references, it's just called the firmament. The last 4, it's called the firmament of the heavens, indicating 2 different firmaments, one of the earth and another of the heavens. The Hebrew word means something solid, something that's stretched out. And so the Bible says that God created the earth and it was covered with water. That was day 1. Day 2, God made the firmament and he divided the waters under the firmament from the waters above. So that day 2 is not just the creation of the atmosphere. That doesn't really merit a whole day in the creation scheme of things. But day 2, God created the paradise that mankind would live on, the entire crust of the earth. And then 5 chapters later, when God introduces Noah's flood, we find out that that crust would break open, the fountains of the great deep would burst forth, and all that water from under the crust would flood the earth. That's what was going on. And in fact, that's where the rain came from. When the water gushed up from under the earth, it went up into the atmosphere, and much of it fell down as rain for 40 days. So the last 4 times the word firmament is used in Genesis 1, it's the other firmament. Each time Moses writes the firmament of the heavens, of the heavens, of the heavens, because he's talking about the sky where the birds fly and the outer space where the sun, the moon, and the stars are. But the beginning on day 2, when God made the firmament to divide the waters under the crust from the waters above the crust, that was not the sky. That was the firmament, the crust of the earth that mankind lives on. And that would be really obvious, except for the middle reference. I said Moses used that word 9 times. The last 4, it says the firmament of the heavens. The first 4, it says just the firmament. Well, the 5th one, the one in the middle, says that God called the firmament heaven. And so that makes everyone think, oh, there was only one firmament. But they miss it because when God made Adam and Eve, he put them in heaven on earth. They were part of God's kingdom of heaven. When Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven, it's not just in heaven, in God's throne room, it's also on earth. But once man rebelled, earth became so much like hell, so much more like hell than heaven, it's hard for us to remember that when God created the earth and put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, it was like heaven on earth. That was part of the sphere of heaven. And beneath the crust of the earth, that is where hell would be. Hell would be beneath the surface of the earth. So that the surface of the earth was the beginning of the spheres of heaven. First, there was God's kingdom of heaven on earth. And then there was the atmosphere, and then outer space, and then God's throne room. Those were the spheres of heaven as you go outward. Excellent question. And the canopy theory has far less support today than it did 10 years ago. And part of the reason is because Walt Brown's hydroplate theory is doing such a great job showing that the Bible was very literal in how it presented what was going on with the creation and Noah's flood. Now let's go to Aurora. Pat, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
Hey, Bob. In light of Walt Brown's theory that the mountains have formed rapidly, do you think that Yellowstone's Heart Mountain could have been broken up rather quickly or over a short amount of time?
Fabulous question. Pat, at Denver Bible Church in the last couple months, we've talked about Heart Mountain in Yellowstone. I just went to Yellowstone with my family this past summer. Creationists learn about it because it's so fascinating. It turns out that this Heart Mountain, they call it actually Heart Mountain Detachment, this massive chunk of a mountain that broke up into 50 pieces. And of course, geologists for the last century, they would say that happened over millions of years or thousands of years. But the latest opinion among geologists, and this comes from Geology, there's a journal, peer-reviewed scientific journal called Geology, just this past year in 2006, that the Heart Mountain Detachment may have taken place, that it was catastrophic, it was a major slide, and it might, now Pat, get this, they're not saying millions of years, they're not saying thousands of years, they're saying it may have taken place in only 30 minutes.
I believe that. I'll be looking out the window of the plane as I fly out the Southwest next week.
Oh boy, Pat, you'll be flying right over some of this terrain that Walt Brown is talking about. And I've taken that flight probably 30 times, and I always try to get a window seat, and I look carefully. You could do the same thing on Google Earth, but what you're going to see is the results of a massive floodplain. It'll be a lot of fun. Hope you have a great trip.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
God bless you, Pat. Appreciate that call. All right, now from Tampa Bay, Florida. In fact, one of the members of TheologyOnline.com, my favorite website, Johnny, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
Thanks, Bob. How are you today?
Doing great. Thanks, sir.
Just wanted to call and comment on two of the things you said in your show. Mainly just one thing, because you've had in your signature for quite some time one of my quotes. Is that correct?
Yes. I quote you on Theology Online where we were talking about evolution, and you said evolution is not about an increase in information. And I've wanted you to retract that when speaking generally about Darwinism and the evolution of the species from molecules to man, that evolution is about an increase in information.
Well, see, you want me to retract that in a general sense, but if you read what I posted, I said, I'm not saying that there hasn't been a trend towards increasing complexity or increasing organization, both of which you might define as an increase in information. I'm talking about, in the sense of evolution as a theory, there is no direction when you say if something has evolved or has devolved. There's no such direction. If it loses information, and that loss of information is increasing frequency into the population, then we say that, you know, the population is still evolved.
Okay, now let me ask you this. Could you get from amoebas and protozoans to man without a massive increase in information? Is that possible? Could you get there just by losing information?
No, you could not.
Okay, so is Darwinism, is the theory of evolution basically that species have evolved from single-celled organisms? Is that basically Darwinism?
Darwinism is basically, it posits to explain the distribution of species from a common ancestor.
Right. So, yes, and so to come from single-celled organisms to modern species, including the whole animal kingdom, plant kingdom, and man. So if you're to describe Darwinism, to go from single-celled organisms to mankind, doesn't that overwhelmingly require an increase in information?
Yes, and I've never contended otherwise.
Johnny, in our discussion, I read what you wrote very carefully.
Okay.
And the reason I made such a big deal out of it is because this is what we creationists put up with all the time when a Darwinist, an evolutionist, the scientist, the biologist will say evolution is not about an increase in information. And that is
okay,
the fundamental. Is this right? Is this correct? The fundamental issue regarding Darwinism from amoebas to man is an increase in information. That's the fundamental issue. True
that
or false?
That is the overall trend.
True or false?
The overall pattern.
So is it true? Can you give me a true or false? Maybe I could remove that from my signature. Is this a true statement that evolution, Darwinism, from single-cell organism to man is overwhelmingly about an increase in information? Yes or no?
I've already told you that. Yes, twice.
Okay, good. All right, we have it clear.
However, when do we say population is evolving?
Okay, Johnny, I know you want to point out that also there's a loss of information and there are mutations that cause degradation. Now, let me ask you this. Do creationists agree?
Can you answer my question before
Go ahead.
Okay. When do we say a population has evolved?
You might say when it gets worse, when it breaks down, that's evolution.
Who is used. Who is you?
You. I'm talking about you and somebody debating a creationist. Generally,
how about a biology book? What would a biology book say defining as an evolving population?
The reason
would
they would say here's the reason, Johnny, that you and others would say that. Because you could point to many examples of degradation of the gene pool, of mutations causing diseases, but you can't point to many examples of improvements in added information in the genome. So therefore, you have to argue, here is proof of evolution. Sickle cell anemia is proof of evolution, and we say that's a breakdown, that's degenerative, that's a mutation that brings about disease, and you say, yeah, that's a perfect example of evolution. Let me ask you this. Creationists agree that there are breakdowns in the genome? Do creationists agree with that?
Sure. Yeah, I hear it all the time.
Yeah. So for you guys to trumpet that evolution includes a breakdown in the DNA, so what? We all agree that there's disease and that things break down. What you guys have to prove is that there is an increase in information over the millennia and the millions of years.
Okay.
So that's your challenge to prove that, and we assert that you can't because it hasn't happened and mutations are overwhelmingly destructive. Hey, Johnny, wouldn't it be a bad leg long before it's a good wing?
Before we get to that, I'll answer that question.
All right.
Before we get that, if you were to open a biology book, okay, and it were to define evolution as a process acting on a population, how would it define that? What would it say in there?
It might say that any change, any genetic change is evolution.
Okay, and that
wouldn't be helpful because both sides of the debate...
By definition, I am correct. By definition. Is that correct?
If they define it that way, it's because they know, Johnny, they have a bias. And because of their bias...
You're the one who wrote the theory. Why would there be a bias?
The bias is because they can't find evidence of an increase in information. So they want to say that evolution includes disease and breakdown and mutations. And we, the creationist side, agree with that. So that's not a very helpful way of looking at evolution. You have the challenge to prove that there's an increase in information. And the fact that you guys always run to disease and breakdowns is proof that you don't have a lot of evidence to show that the genome gets more complex by natural law and survival of the fittest.
Now, what do you mean we always run?
You run to disease.
Can you give me an example?
TOL is filled with it. I've already mentioned one. Let's go to this now. You guys say that reptiles evolved into birds.
Okay,
so you need limbs like arms or legs to evolve into wings. And survival of the fittest, it would take what? Thousands of generations of small mutations for legs or arms, limbs, to gradually change into wings. And it would be a bad leg long before it's a valuable wing. So survival of the fittest, natural selection, would weed out all the organisms with bad legs.
Okay. Would it?
Yeah.
Do T-Rex have really... Actually, let's clarify here. Legs and arms are different.
Yeah, that's right. And reptiles...
We're talking about arms. We're not talking about legs.
Yeah, right? Today reptiles go around on all fours. A T-Rex is considered a reptile that had legs and had somewhat useful arms, hands.
Okay. Somewhat useful arms.
Yeah.
What did he use his arms for?
I bet he used his arms for a lot of things, Johnny. Every time we were told by the evolutionists that our body had all kinds of organisms that were worthless, they were left over, they had no function.
I am not saying his arms are worthless. It's hypothesized that he used them to mate.
He may have used them
to get off the ground.
Let me finish.
He certainly didn't pick cherries off a tree and run around on all fours.
Let me finish the point. We're told dozens of organs in the human body had no function. They're left over, like the hypothalamus, and then we find out these organs
hypothalamus is not hypothesized to have no function.
Stop the tape. Let me interrupt my own show. On our website, when we make an error on the program, we point it out, and I thought I'd point it out in the program itself so as not to spread misinformation. On this point, Johnny is correct. I was in error. The hypothalamus was not considered vestigial. I was wrong to include it among the organs that evolutionists claimed had no function. It's part of the endocrine system, and science was slowed up. It was retarded for more than 50 years, as much of the endocrine system was considered useless, which is just one example of how Darwinism has impeded good science. Because of evolutionary dogma, medical science was slow to recognize functions of so many organs and glands, the tonsils, the appendix, which, by the way, works in combination with lymph nodes to filter out harmful bacteria. And because of its location, the appendix is in a good spot to help protect the small intestines from bacteria in our large intestines. But back to the hypothalamus, I had heard that the pituitary and pineal glands, also part of the endocrine system, were considered vestigial. So to verify Johnny's claim, as soon as the program ended, I called a friend of this radio show, an endocrinologist back east, Dr. Joel Brind. He's professor of endocrinology at Baruch College in New York City, and Joel explained to me that the hypothalamus wasn't recognized early on because it's not a distinct organ. It's not even a separate gland, but it's comprised of clusters of neurons in the brain. It's part of the brain. And so I understood why, when historically much of the endocrine system had been wrongly tagged by evolutionists as having lost all or their major functions, the hypothalamus wasn't identified that way because it hadn't yet been recognized, back when bias and ignorance moved evolutionary scientists to identify so many structures as vestigial. But the bottom line here is I appreciate Johnny correcting that. We don't want to spread misinformation. So let's rejoin the show with Johnny correcting me. Like the hypothalamus, and then we find out these organs
that... Actually, hypothalamus is not hypothesized to have no function.
But the point is that we find out it had great function. So when I hear an evolutionist like Dr. Eugenie Scott say on my show 7 years ago that junk DNA has no function, and today we're finding out when there's a mutation in the junk DNA, it causes disease, and that junk DNA plays all kinds of a role that we didn't understand 10 years ago, you have to forgive me when evolutionists say the forearms of a T-Rex had not much of a function. I think they had a brilliant function.
Did I say that?
No, you didn't, but you were headed there.
Okay, so why are we talking about that? Why is that relevant? All I'm saying, Bob, is that, you know, there's got to be, I don't know exactly how it happened. I'm not an expert on reptile, you know, on reptile
Well, can't you admit this, Johnny? You're not an expert, but can't you admit that survival of the fittest, a leg that was gradually over thousands of generations going to evolve into a wing, that it would be a very bad leg long before it was a good wing. Could you, an arm. Could you admit that an arm that was evolving into a wing, that long before it was a good wing, it would be a very bad arm? Could you admit that?
Sure. I'll admit that, and let me give you the caveat with that.
Yeah.
The caveat is, when you define a good arm, you have to specify a function for that arm. My hand is not very good for lifting boulders. My arm is not very good for lifting boulders. My body is not very good for lifting boulders.
Right.
So I can't say that I have a bad body because I can't lift boulders.
No, of course not.
It has to be a function. You're relating that to a function.
Right. And so as your arm, your skeleton, as that skeleton is going from hands, arms that are somewhat useful, and the bones are beginning to hollow out, and you're beginning to develop feathers that are pretty much useless for your function, then you need to posit thousands of intermediary stages between arms and wings, where every stage helps the survival of that species to propagate its DNA, and that, we submit, on the surface is absurd. You don't have cows gradually going back into the sea to evolve into whales, and that somehow their nostril evolves into a blowhole. It's just absurd on the face of it.
Okay. And you can't imagine, just hypothetically, a series of events that might lead to an arm becoming less and less functionally useful for the survival of the species, and let's say a feathered arm becoming more and more useful for the survival of a certain species. I mean,
I think that is just as bizarre.
Look at the arms on a T-Rex. I am not saying they are functionless. I'm sure they had a function. I'm sure maybe he, you know, like I said earlier, he may have got up with them. They may have helped him mate. But he certainly didn't crawl around on all fours. Is that correct?
Johnny?
I mean, he got by with less functional arms. Now, if there was a mutation, let's say, that helped him run faster, it increased the aerodynamics of the arm, he could potentially not suffer a serious low in his survivability because his functions that his arms are for are not affected by that mutation.
Yeah.
In other words, he's not hunting with his arms.
All right. When we look at this picture, and to me, it is so obviously absurd. Mm-hmm. You have fish that come out of the sea and become mammals, and then you have cows or some mammal that goes back into the surf and evolves into a whale. And there are no stages where gradually the fins evolve and lungs evolve and the blood circulation changes and the whole ability for oxygen to come into the body and pass through and be processed. There are no step by step by step where those transitions can occur without killing the creature. So you could make what I view as bizarre arguments for limbs evolving into wings over what? 10,000 generations?
I can't.
Yeah, try to quantify it sometime. Try to quantify how many generations.
That's not the job of an evolution. We don't.
No, it is, because not only
because our theory is not about quantifying the steps, the intermediate steps.
That's a cop out.
That there were intermediate.
Johnny, that's a cop out, and here's why. Because
it's not a cop out.
It is a cop out because there's. Johnny, here's why. Tell me if this is true. There are a certain number of stages or steps that any transition would go through, and there's a certain amount of time for those stages to take place, like to go from Australopithecus to Homo sapien. Over 5 million years, if there are millions of discrete changes to the DNA, and each change would take some thousands of years for that change in one little baby chimp to now propagate through the whole genome, whether there's 10,000 organisms or 10 million, it's going to take some thousands of years, and now you need a second change to take place, and a third.
Bob, stop there. That's wrong. Evolution does not occur in series. This is not a series event. This is a parallel event. Populations evolve.
You could have multiple, Johnny. I will give you that you have multiple mutations going into the genome simultaneously. But there are millions of discrete genetic differences between Australopithecus and Homo sapiens.
And you know that do we sequence Australopithecus? Do we know how many mutations there are between us and Australopithecus?
Australopithecus is no longer, it's an extinct species.
Okay, so we
look at the closest living species. Australopithecus is closer to an ape than an ape is to a human.
Okay.
We know that. And Australopithecus, their inner ear, they walked on
orphan. How do we know that?
Huh?
How do we know that?
Because the measurements of their skull, their inner ear, they walked on all fours. Their fingers were curved for swinging in trees.
Right now, because you're talking about the genome. But carry on.
Yeah. So for that genome, how long does it take, would you guess, for one mutation to propagate through an average species of primates on Earth so that it's through the whole genome? Do you think it happens in 50 years?
I have absolutely no idea.
Is it relevant? Is it relevant?
Yes.
Okay, it's relevant because if it takes hundreds of thousands of years to get one mutation to propagate through the whole genome, and then you have millions of mutations that need to propagate, you can't do it in 5 million years. You can't do it in a billion years.
You know what a series event is? If I say that happened in series, what does that mean? That means one happened after the other.
No, I already granted that you could have multiple mutations propagating simultaneously.
Why do you keep saying that if it takes 1,000 years for one and then 1,000 years for the next and there's millions of...
Here's why. Here's why, Johnny.
That's a series event.
I'll tell you why. I'll answer your question. I'll answer your question. Because there are millions of discrete differences and they can't all have happened at once. Because that would contradict Darwinism, and that would be the hopeful monster theory.
Once, but they don't all have to happen individual mutations.
I will grant you the most beneficial possible multiple mutations propagating simultaneously. You make the mathematical model, and you will see that it is preposterous to happen in 5 million years.
You know, you're talking about Haldane's dilemma. That's been addressed numerous times. However, let me just ask you this. How long ago were humans created?
Humans were created less than 10,000 years ago.
Okay.
Johnny, this is going to be our last topic because I want to get to more callers. Go ahead.
How different am I from you genetically?
What, a hundredth of 1%? I'm not sure.
Okay. The number of mutations that occurred per year to get from Adam to me would have to be greater than the number of mutations from an ape, let's say 10 million years ago, to me. Per year, mutational load per year. Because I've actually already posted on this numerous times that if you assume Adam was created 6,000 years ago, then you've got a heck of a lot of mutations being incorporated.
No, not really. Mitochondrial Eve.
No, you do. If you look at
Johnny, mitochondria has DNA that's not nuclear. It's not from the nucleus. Some of the DNA is in the mitochondria organelle itself. Mm-hmm. And mitochondrial Eve has been posited by evolutionary scientists. First, they'd say 100,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, and now around 10,000 years ago. I'm not talking about from creationists. I'm talking about from atheistic evolutionists.
You're talking about outdated research. That was from hypermutable spots on the mitochondrial DNA. Subsequent research on non-hypermutatable spots show that, you know, maybe the original figure was better because we're looking at mutated spots that have heavy mutation loads.
All right.
I'm not talking about mitochondrial Eve.
All right,
talking about
Johnny.
Nuclear DNA. And if you look, let me just close with this. If you look it up, you will find that the number of mutations that had to have occurred between Adam 6,000 years ago and me now, because of the average difference between me and, say, you, is far greater than the number of mutations that had to have occurred in a 5
okay,
million,
and of course,
million year period.
And Johnny, DNA genetics is a fabulous science started by Mendel.
It is. I encourage you to study it.
Started by Mendel, who rejected Darwinism. And creationists are mining the tremendous wealth of genetic science for overwhelming evidence that we were created.
Science. Let me tell you, all
that we were created. Johnny, thank you. I appreciate your call. Please call again.
Okay, Bob. Have a good day.
Okay, today's a quick show. God made us to express tremendous differences so that we could have uniqueness in the organisms of plants, animals, and especially human beings. Let's go right back to the phones now. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, Wayne, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
Thank you. I had a question. You kind of touched on it a little bit, but in a little different way. I was wondering if the earth was split open, like it says in the Bible, and then we had the great waters come forth.
Right. The Bible says that the fountains of the great deep broke forth.
Right. Okay. And Noah was in the ark at this time with the animals.
Right.
right? And so the continents are beginning to split apart at that time, is that correct?
Yeah, to slide apart. North and South America sliding to the west, and right. Europe and Africa sliding to the east.
Okay, so if Noah had all of the animals, then how did we get the animals on the isolated continents like Australia and the Americas?
That's a great question. If you recall, Walt Brown touched on this briefly, that after the flood, the continents were connected with massive land bridges because the water was way below what we today think of as sea level. And then the continents gradually sunk into the mantle, back into the mantle, and sea level increased. And that's why the Bible says in the days of Peleg, the earth was divided, because the land bridges that even geologists today recognize, that you lower sea level just by a few hundred feet today, and you connect the continents with land bridges. So animals were able to migrate, as were people, after the flood, in the centuries after the flood, over these massive land bridges connecting Australia to Asia, Asia to North America, North America to Europe, and so on.
I see. Well, on the opposite end of that question, then, how is it that certain continents have species-specific animals that are only found in certain continents?
Sure, because not all animals would have migrated everywhere before the Earth was divided as sea level rose and separated the continents. So some migration, that explains why we have woolly mammoths on different continents, because they were able to migrate on these massive land bridges. They didn't swim the oceans.
Okay. And I have a second question.
Sure.
As NASA is looking for life on Mars and they search these meteors for different life, amoeba or bacteria or so forth.
Right.
If they do find one of these, wouldn't that be from the fountains of the deep opening up and all this material getting thrown into space?
Absolutely.
Wouldn't that have originated from Earth?
Wayne, absolutely. And that's what's so funny. The Earth is the living planet. We are the water planet. We are the planet with life on the solar system. So when we find life on Earth, the atheists and evolutionists, to show how desperate they are, they'll say, well, maybe it came from Mars, which is dead. Why did the life on Earth come from Mars? Mars is dead. If we find a meteorite that we think came from Mars and it has some dead remnant of bacteria or protozoan or something in it.
Right. Wouldn't it come from the place that has life?
Right. It came from Earth. It came from Earth. But they're so determined to be blind. They're actively blind against all the evidence that God created us. He loves us. And he gave us this earth to be a paradise, but we have rebelled against God.
Right.
Thank you so much, Wayne.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye. Our phone number, 1-800-8-N-YARDS, 1-800-836-9278. Now let's go to Dayton, Ohio. Nathan, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
Hey, Bob. I really enjoyed the programs you had with Dr. Walt Brown. It was really fascinating.
Thanks.
I had a question about his hydroplate theory.
Right.
You'll have to forgive me because I went to public school, so I'm not exactly well-versed in all the textbook theories. If I understand correctly, what's usually taught in the textbooks is the plate tectonic theory or something like that.
Right, exactly, and that the continents are on different plates, and those plates move very slowly, so that,
right.
For example,
inches along per year or something like that.
Yeah, or fractions of an inch per year over millions of years. And so North and South America separated from Europe and Africa.
Okay. And if you could just go over what his hydroplate theory, because what he was saying is that what they say used to be Pangaea originally.
Right.
But the continent separated really rapidly during the flood.
And that's where creationists agree with geologists generally, that there was one continent before the flood. And the Bible says that God had the dry land appear. And then there were the waters. And so during the flood, the crust of the earth literally cracked open. And about 10 miles down, there was a subterranean chamber of water, about 3/4 of a mile thick, around the entire earth. So it wasn't just a subterranean ocean. It was a sphere, like a slice of a shell of a sphere under the whole crust. Massive quantity of water. And
right.
when the crust of the Earth cracked, that's what formed the mid-oceanic ridge. Back in your public school days, did you learn about the mid-Atlantic ridge or the mid-oceanic ridge?
I can recall vaguely, but...
yeah, right. Well, me too. Vaguely. So there's this mountain range, 46,000 miles long, under the ocean that goes around the whole Earth. Like Walt Brown right. says, it's like a seam on a baseball, the way it goes around the Earth. And when that cracked open and the water gushed up from under the Earth, in the Atlantic, what happened was it began eroding the continent above the crack. So the reason it looks like North and South America can fit together with Europe and Africa, it looks like that because the crack formed in a certain way, and the erosion went out from that crack. So the continental shelves of the continents, they parallel that crack to some extent. And so it looks like you could fit the continents together, but they're really parallel to the mid-Atlantic ridge, not to one another. They're
right.
beautifully parallel to the ridge as compared to one another. And so when that started to erode away what is today the Atlantic Ocean, that part of the crust became way lighter than the rest of the crust. And since it's all under pressure, all the rest of the crust is pushing down. And so that part of the Earth started to push upward. And as that pushed upward and the crust had cracked, the continents began to slide. North and South America started sliding to the west. And Europe and Africa and Asia started sliding to the east. And underneath them was water.
Right.
Eventually, it hit bottom, so to speak. And the friction was so much that it overcame the sliding. And the continents came to a screeching halt. And they crushed, they thickened, and they buckled. And that buckling became the mountain ranges of the Earth. Most of them are north-south and are roughly parallel to the mid-Atlantic ridge.
Right.
And so that explains to us the mountain ranges and that they were formed rapidly.
And all of this happened not over dozens of years, but over, what, hours, days?
Over, exactly, hours and days. Exactly, the mountain ranges of the world formed. Except for later, like the volcanic activity in the Pacific. Walt Brown mentioned there's about 40,000 active volcanoes still today in the Pacific. And that's because in the mantle of the Earth and in the core, as the Atlantic is rising, the Pacific is sinking in. And think of that massive friction that has to go through the whole center of the Earth to allow that to happen for the Atlantic floor to rise. And the Pacific is being sucked in. That's why we have the deepest trenches in the world in the Pacific. And there's this rim of fire in the Pacific and all these volcanoes. And that also is possibly what heats up the Pacific, causing El Ninos. The warm Pacific every few years causes this warm weather pattern that changes the weather of the Earth.
Right.
And so as the Pacific basically is sucking in, it's becoming like practically molten. And it is sucking in the Pacific as it's pushing upward in the Atlantic.
And right.
And the continents are sliding away from that. All right?
All right. Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed you having Dr. Walt Brown on your show.
He was just great. Thank you so much, Nathan. I appreciate that. So calls from Colorado, from Florida, calls from Oklahoma and Ohio. And now it's your turn. 1-800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. Now let's go to the phones again. Vic from Aurora, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, Vic.
I think after Johnny, I could use a Tylenol.
Yeah, I guess so.
Maybe I'll evolve something that'll take care of that.
Yeah, I hope so.
I just wanted to commend you on that Walt Brown guy.
Yeah.
Man, that was amazing. I'm often talking with my wife about evolution and all this stuff I hear on your show, and
yeah.
She wasn't all that interested in, but I got her listening to the archive broadcast on your website.
Yeah.
She started there about 7 o'clock, I guess, last night, and around 10:15 when I checked on her, she was still listening.
Oh, wow.
She's sort of like a public school secret agent, I like to call her. She teaches at a high school. She's a special education teacher.
All right.
And she sits in on the physical science classes and
yeah.
poses questions from time to time.
So I'm so thrilled that she's able to listen. You know, we keep those archives for years, and what we're starting to do is compile lists of them by topic so that somebody who's interested in creation, evolution, science, they could go through a science list and check out all those programs. Somebody else interested in abortion or the death penalty, they could listen to those.
I don't know if this is, you know, within the realm of the discussion, but I was wondering, you know, that gap theory that I've heard before?
The gap theory, sure.
Yeah, Genesis. I wonder if you could expound on with your opinion on that.
Yeah,
a little.
Some people say, and this became popular, especially after Darwinism, most of Western civilization adopted the belief that the earth was millions of years old. And so the Christians, before creation science became a significant movement, with hundreds, if not thousands, of scientists around the world adding to the body of evidence that God created the earth in the recent past, before that movement, Christians would look at the evolution argument and they'd say, we're not scientists, we can't confront this. So they modified their interpretation of Scripture to say there must have been a gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. It's called the gap theory. It was in the Scofield Reference Bible and C.S. Lewis. Many Christians adopted the gap theory. Well, in Exodus, in the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20, God says that he gave the Sabbath, that Israelites should not work on Saturday, the seventh day of the week. God said, because in 6 days I created the heavens, the earth, the seas, and everything in them. The Ten Commandments themselves do not leave any room for a gap after the initial creation of the heavens and the earth through the sixth day when God made man. So according to the Bible, there is no gap. The sun was created on day 4. The trees were created on the 3rd day, showing us that the days themselves were not long epochs or millions of years, but they were normal 24-hour days.
I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you for calling
in
so much.
Bye.
May God bless you. It's great to get so many neat calls on such an important topic. Let's go now to Denver, Colorado. Alan, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
Hi, Bob.
Howdy.
I wanted to talk to you about one topic that's in Walt Brown's book that I haven't heard you explain. It's about the frozen mammoth.
Okay.
They have found numerous frozen mammoths plus some rhinoceros and a horse and other animals in Siberia. And it appears they've been flash frozen because they're, some of them have still internal organs and and food in their stomach that they found. And this food, some of it is of grasses and other temperate plants that show that the climate was definitely warmer. And Walt Brown explains his theory of the fountains of the great deep. He explains that the water and material that came out of those fountains, some of it would rain down in the Arctic regions.
Right, exactly. When the water shot up from 10 miles below the surface of the earth, came out of the mid-oceanic ridge, some of it was ejected into outer space. But some of that water never escaped Earth's gravity, and so it fell down, and it would have been super chilled because of how high up into the atmosphere it got.
Walt Brown explains that to have the mammoths preserved and their stomach contents preserved so quickly, their outside temperature would have to go down to minus 175 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's awfully cold.
And it's a lot different than evolutionary scientists that say that, well, it just got slowly cold when the Ice Age came and the mammoths couldn't survive.
Yeah, if it got slowly cold, then that wouldn't work because as their bodies were gradually freezing, getting caught in a snowslide or something, then the food in their digestive tract would still be digested. Because it takes a long time to freeze something on the inside of a living mammoth.
Yeah.
I found that part in his book. He said the stomach is protected inside a warm body, 96.6 degrees Fahrenheit for elephants. So how cold must the outside air become to drop the stomach's temperature to 40 degrees Fahrenheit to stop the digestive process? And he says that experiments have shown that the outer layers of skin would have had to drop suddenly to at least 175 degrees below zero Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
And so his hydroplate theory offers a mechanism for how that happened. The water comes up from beneath the earth. The fountains of the great deep launch even comets into outer space. Some of that water goes so high in the atmosphere that it nearly escapes, but it doesn't. And it rains back down. And on the poles, it comes down as freezing cold ice.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent observation. And that chapter is fascinating in Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning. It's just a great chapter. And especially the chart he has in there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, sir, very much.
Okay.
Appreciate that call.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Great call so far. Now in Denver, Colorado, Brian, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
Hi there. I have two questions for you.
Yes, sir.
My first is regarding hydroplate theory versus plate tectonics. I want to know how it's possible that textbook publishers can get away with printing such blatantly inaccurate information.
Mm.
The drawings of the early world are totally contrived. Continents are turned, resized. And not only that, but the writers of the books, as far as I know, they still cite peppered moths and even embryo recapitulation.
For example, they say, look, humans evolve. The embryo, the baby in the womb, goes through the stages of evolution. Like at one point, it's like a fish and it has gills and it goes through the reptilian. That was all bogus.
Yeah.
It was fabricated drawings of embryos. And that's been known to have been a scam for so many decades. The peppered moth scam, that's not evolution. It's just light and dark moths. And that has been known to not show evolution at all. And also, like you said, the jigsaw fit of the continents, Walt Brown has pointed out, they don't fit together. But in fact, they do fit along the mid-Atlantic ridge. But that doesn't support their plate tectonics theory. So they get away with it. The media doesn't call them on it. The errors in the textbooks are rampant, especially regarding science. And the simplest science shows the evidence that God created us. And that's why it's obscured in our public schools. Because when you know the basic truth about the moon, you see how God gave us the moon that the Big Bang and atheists can't even begin to explain. You said you had two questions.
Yeah, my second question is, I was talking to my cousin who's an evolutionist, and he asked me to just disprove evolution to him. I mean, I think he's seeking, and to me, the evidence is so vast and overwhelming, I don't even know where to begin. I want to know what you would have said if he had asked you to just disprove evolution to him.
Is he asking specifically, do you think, to disprove evolution or atheism?
Evolution. I mean, I was talking to him about absolutism, and it ended up getting into evolution.
Okay, great. I like to point out, to start with, the laws of science do not allow the universe to be created from nothing, nor could it have been burning and working forever. So it had to originate in the recent past by something outside of the universe. That talks about the creation of the entire universe. But then when you come to biological life, life is so wildly complicated that original proteins and original cell could not happen by chance. And even if you do take all the compounds for a cell, like in a corpse that's decomposing, like a dead horse, you have everything you need for life, but there's no life. You need life to come from life. That's what you need. And life, we are self-aware. We have consciousness. And atoms and molecules are not self-aware. They can't be self-aware. But we are, which shows us that we were made in the image and likeness of a God who is conscious, a God that is self-aware. And then our conscience tells us there's right and wrong. And that's evidence that our creator is a moral God. And then when you look at organisms, for example, that are mobile, they could walk around, they could fly, they could swim, they have vision systems, eyesight, they have radar. You point out that those systems I love Walt Brown's point that it would be a bad leg long before it evolved into a good wing.
I love that point. Yeah,
yeah, so if it's survival of the fittest, ask them on theologyonline.com, the atheists, the scientists, the doctors, the biologists for the past week, they haven't been able to answer how do you survive with a bad leg as it's evolving into a good wing. How does that happen over 1,000 years or a million years?
And also, how do you evolve a vital organ when, by definition, you can't be alive without a vital organ?
Yeah, without a vital organ. And Walt Brown said, okay, they think a two-chamber heart could evolve from a one-chamber heart. What in the world does a one-chamber heart evolve from? It's really funny. It is funny. And when you have complex systems that then interact with one another, it is not possible that random changes to complex systems can produce added functionality and complexity.
Now, what about the theistic evolutionist who thinks God has guided evolution and that's why it's possible, even though it's completely contrived?
Okay, well, God could cause life to begin and then have it evolve. That's theoretically possible, at least, except that the fossil record does not indicate that evolution has taken place. And there is overwhelming evidence and observations against the theory of billions of years.
I would usually say, as a Christian, I want to cite the Bible because God never states at all that he used time and chance to create everything we see.
Of course not. He designed it, and he did all that in 6 days, 6 literal days. Thank you, Brian, so much for your call.
Thank you.
May God bless you. The Bible tells us, be ready to give an answer to those who ask. And if we educate ourselves, we prepare, we really can give answers to those who are wondering about God's creation. So we encourage you, get Walt Brown's book, While Supplies Last, here at Bob and Yurt Live. We have autographed copies. Our phone number, 800-8-N-YARTS. That's 1-800-836-9278. You could also get it on our web store at kgov.com. Click on store and go to literature. Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning, and we have something you will love, a science pack. Wow, for $99.99, you get 5 fabulous resources. Unlocking the Mysteries of Life, The Privileged Planet, Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning, My Bible Study, Genesis Creation, it's an album, and also The Debate, The Age of the Earth, on CD. So you will just love the science pack. So you could order that or call up and just ask for Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning. You can get either of those online or by calling us. So may God bless you. We appreciate you tuning in to Bob and Yurt Live. Creation evolution is one of our favorite topics. And we have a program, Real Science Friday. Every few weeks, we have a fabulous program on creation, evolution, and the global flood. We also talk about all the issues of the day. The moral issues, God created us in his image, and that means do not steal, do not murder, don't commit adultery, and don't commit perjury. So may God bless you all. Thanks for tuning in, and please pray for the ministry of Walt Brown. God bless you.